Today, my guest is Joseph Pfeiffer St. James from, where are you from?
The Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul of Minnesota.
And?
And Palm Springs, California.
As of what, a year ago?
As of December of 22.
Okay. A couple years almost.
A couple years.
Yeah, year and a half.
I go back and forth and consider this paradise.
I don't know where to start with you. Yeah. Normally, most of my listeners know that I talk for 15 minutes, 20 minutes with my guests before. But we talked for over 2 hours when you were here the other day, and we didn't have time to do the podcast.
That's right. And so you know, it's not the first time in my life somebody looked at me and said, I don't know where to start with you.
Where do I start with you? Your outfit's really interesting. I mean, like, yellow tights? Wow.
I don't have yellow tights on.
I know.
I have worn tights, though. I did theater. I did children's theater a lot.
Okay, we're not going to go there.
Yeah.
He's not wearing yellow tights. I just like to embarrass people.
One of my skills is putting on tights without putting my foot through them. So there you go.
How do you do that?
You curl your toes and you roll it all up. And yeah, really? there's a whole skill set.
Wow.
I ruined several pairs before I...
Where do we want to start? You're doing... Let's talk about your show. Let's start with that.
Okay, yeah.
And then we'll go back.
It's a good place to start. Today is April 18th, and on May 5th in Minneapolis, I will be doing the second production of Guts and Gratitude, a widower's cabaret. Because I am a widower, and I'm also a musician and an actor, and have done some comedy. And so it's a big story, so should I just...
Yeah, go right, dig into it.
Okay. So on June 12th of 2021, my husband of 16 years was murdered basically in our driveway. And I was there. He was murdered by our neighbor who had severe mental illness. And my husband, Paul Pfeiffer, was walking to the mailbox and our neighbor was sitting in wait for him because he knew that Paul did this. You know, whenever he pulled in the driveway, he'd walk to the mailbox. He had said things to Paul previously that made Paul think that he was homophobic. Paul didn't catch on that he was actually mentally ill. Mm-hmm. And he lay in wait, and then he screeched his tires and aimed for Paul and ran over him with his big black Chevy SUV. I was there. I wasn't facing it, thank God, but I heard it. And knew immediately what it was because I knew where Paul was and what he was doing. And I was actually up on our balcony and I looked over and I saw my husband laying on the ground right behind our house. And I ran down the stairs, out the garage, screaming his name. After this happened, I really didn't have a voice for a couple of weeks.
And, right.
So I just was screaming and screaming, and neighbors came running, and one of my neighbors is a nurse, and she started CPR and instructed me on what to do, and I'm crying and sobbing and in shock and panicked and traumatized, and she had to keep reminding me to breathe. She was doing the pumping, and I was doing the breathing, and the whole time that I was doing this, I was talking to him because I could see his eyes, and I knew he was dying. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted him to hear me loving him while he was going. And that was important to me. I've always kind of believed that spirits can see what's going on around them while they're dying. And I wanted him to know how much I loved him and how sorry I was that this happened. And then she'd interrupt and say, breathe. And then I would breathe. And then another neighbor who's a paramedic came and he started taking over the compressions.
Right.
At that point in time, neighbors are gathering. I am standing there, panicked. I called 911. I called 911 before we started the CPR. And other people did too, but there's a recording out there of my 911 call, which is pretty traumatic. But
whoa.
And then I went on Facebook and I posted, "The haters tried to kill Paul. Please pray, pray, pray." Because our understanding is that this guy was homophobic.
Right.
So that's what we knew at that moment. Paul did die. He went to the to the trauma hospital in Minneapolis, and he died that night. And I work for the hospital.
Hmm.
I worked at a different location of the hospital system, but I worked for those folks. So there were people there in the emergency room that I worked with.
Right.
That
I knew.
And because of that posting, people just showed up at the hospital. There was about 40 between family and friends that just came. They just went to the hospital. And it's a level one trauma hospital. It's the closest one to us. So they just knew that that's where they would be. And so right from the beginning, I had angels all around me in the most traumatic and horrifying moment of my entire life. I was really gifted with angelic human beings. My neighbors, who I never really talked to very much, who stayed in touch with me after this, even after I sold that house because I couldn't live there anymore. They arranged those sets of neighbors and a previous set of neighbors arranged a candlelight vigil. All the friends and family that came to the hospital, it happened. It was immediate. The responses to that Facebook post, there were hundreds and hundreds of responses, and people were saying things like, "Where are you? I can be there in 20 minutes. What do you need? Do I need to send money?" I mean, literally, it just was this waterfall of love. And my life exploded in those few seconds. And I had the experience of a doctor coming out of the emergency room with two nurses by him and the chaplain. And I just saw all three of them coming at me, and they looked very sad and their heads were down. And I looked at him and I said, "You have bad news for me, don't you?" And he said, "Yeah, I do." So it's bizarre sometimes to think that that's actually an experience that I had in my life.
Right.
You see it on TV. You hear about it. I'm now a person who loved someone who, you know, the most important person in my life was murdered, and I'm in a club now. A year before Paul was murdered, the weekend of George Floyd in Minneapolis, a dear friend of ours' daughter, who was also our friend, who had Thanksgiving at our house, she was murdered. And I remember when she was murdered a year prior, I said to Paul, "We're in a club now. It's weird. We know somebody that was murdered. You never think about that. You watch Dateline in 2020 and you watch, you know, murder mysteries and all these things. Right. And then you put your popcorn away and you brush your teeth and go to bed. You don't think about it at all."
Right.
And now, when I got the news about my friend Jenna, that had happened. And now, a year later, I'm standing in an emergency room being told that my husband was murdered. And it was surreal. I was very definitely in shock. My family and my friends tell me from the ways that I was talking that they were worried about me. The doctor, the emergency room doctor, was worried about me. He pulled me in a room. They took my blood pressure. It was sky high. They gave me tranquilizers, and they didn't, I'm glad they did it. They didn't dumb me out. I didn't go to a different planet from those at all. They just made sure I didn't have a heart attack.
Right.
I have heart disease in my family. And at the time I was a 59-year-old man. So, you know, my dad died at 56 of a heart attack.
Well,
so when the doctor heard that, cause my siblings were all there, he was like, "Well, we need to get on top of this." Right after that, though, they brought me into the trauma room. Emergency rooms have trauma rooms.
Mm.
And all the staff that was working on Paul was standing in an arc above his head. I was about 3 feet back from his feet. I couldn't touch him because his body was a crime scene. And they were angels again. Wilkinson, they were standing there, and they had very loving, sad looks on their faces. There was probably 10 of them. It was Saturday night in an inner city trauma emergency room. There were other patients in that place, but these beautiful people were standing there for me and for my husband. And when I worked in healthcare for that system, I worked in training, and I looked at all of them, and the love that I felt wasn't just from them and from their angelic stance, but from their supervisor who said, I think we need to have an in-service to teach these emergency care workers this process for making sure that that family feels very loved and taken care of. And then that person's boss had to approve the payment for that training.
Right.
And I felt all that in those minutes. And I was able, because I worked for the company, I was able to call that boss, that VP. She'd previously been my boss, and tell her how important those people doing their job was to me. And still, right, almost 3 years later, is still such a powerful experience.
Right.
So needless to say, my life exploded. And because of that post where I assumed that this was a hate crime, media jumped on it right away. And it was all over the media. I went immediately to my sister's house. I couldn't go back to our house. And there were media in the front yard for many, many days trying to get a hold of me, wanting a statement from me. My family was saying, no, you're not giving a statement. But they did. You know, they sat with me. What do you want us to say? I have very, very, very wonderful siblings. And I have 3 sisters and 2 sisters-in-law who, like, are an army of women. They are an army of women, and they were not about to let anything or anybody hurt me anymore. And my brother was in there too, but the picture I get is like all these women standing like Charlie's Angels with their arms, right, crossed, right, like, you do not cross this line.
Right.
So they were very protective, and they spoke to the media. And my cousin, my wonderful cousin, who's my best friend, spoke to the media. And Paul Pfeiffer's family, his nephews, he's very close to his nephews, and they spoke to the media, but I didn't have to do that. 2 weeks later, we had his funeral and wake. There also was that candlelight vigil. The press showed up for that too. And then one of the media stations, Care 11 in Minneapolis, St. Paul, which is the big NBC affiliate there, kept trying to talk to me. You know what? After it kind of died down and there wasn't media in our front yard anymore, we're past the funeral, and they kept contacting my attorney saying, we really would like to talk to Joseph. And I just kept saying no. And finally, we asked them, why is this happening? And they were doing a series on a gap in the mental health system in Minnesota, which I've since learned exists in every state. The man that killed my husband, his name is Christopher Rice. He has a mental illness. He's not a homophobe. He's ill.
So did the news people find that out and tell you that?
They eventually did.
That it wasn't.
They were already working on a series about this gap in the healthcare system.
Right, I understand that. Yeah. But how did they make the jump from that this is what's going on?
Because here, then it came out in the media. Yeah, the media discovered that it was actually a mental illness, a mental health crisis that was causing this to happen.
So they went to his family or something, were talking to them, or?
Yeah, and he has public records everywhere. He was arrested right away. After he hit Paul, he drove his car about 3 blocks away, parked it, got out, walked home, and went to bed. And Yeah, and so they went right to his house, and he, you know, he's completely out of it. He's not dealing with reality at all. And then he went to jail, and then he went to, now he's in the mental health system in Minnesota.
Right.
So Care 11 said, we don't just want to do a sensational story. The man that killed Joseph's husband was part of this gap that's in the system. And there are other people who have been killed and hurt because of this gap. And we'd like to interview Joseph because we are focusing on this. And they're teaming up with legislators in Minnesota that are putting together a bill to introduce that will resolve this problem and fill this gap. Basically, the gap is, I have a mental illness. I could possibly be dangerous to myself or to others. And believe me, the vast majority of people are dangerous to themselves more than they're dangerous to other people. But there are some that are dangerous to other people. One of them killed my husband. So I get let out. I go to the hospital. Hospital beds are really short. We need a hospital bed. I get let out provisionally. J- Joseph, if you take your medication, if you show up at your social worker's appointments, if you do all of this stuff, you can stay out. Nobody follows up on that.
So you just said Joseph, though, but you're talking about...
I'm making myself the patient.
Okay, just so I would be clear for my...
I'm making myself the patient.
Right, right. So you're the patient. Okay.
Right. So so nobody follows up on that sick person.
Right.
And there was this whole slew of people that did things like they were let out in a Minnesota winter and walked down three blocks and sat on a park bench and froze to death. Nobody followed up on any of this. And the beds were so short that it was just really a crisis.
So the problem is they're just moving the people out because they don't have room.
Right. And then nobody's following up. Okay. They didn't have the skills to follow up. They'd eventually follow up when these people were brought back into the system. They were brought back into the emergency room. And then we spent all kinds of, police money on dealing with them in an emergency room. So they would just go in and out, revolving door. So they said, this will help pass this legislation. And I was struggling, man. I was drinking loads of vodka on my basement floor and crying and sobbing and grieving and mourning and traumatized. I couldn't get the sound of him being hit out of my head. I can still hear it sitting here almost 3 years later. And I would have trouble if I saw black SUVs with lots of post-traumatic stress. And I think if they did research on me, which they did, they knew that I'd done theater and that I'd been a performer, and they thought he could probably handle this interview. So I did the interview with them. It got me off my basement floor, and I put nice clothes on, and I didn't drink that day. And it went very, very well, and I called them out. I remember the reporter, who has since become my friend, said, so what do you say to the legislators that say we can't afford this? And I got mad, and I said, what's the price? Tell me your price. What's the top dollar you can pay for people that are severely mentally ill? Give me a price. Don't give me this generalization. I want a price. And if the price is you can't pay more than seven, and I have a bunch of eight, nines, and tens, now I can go figure out how to make eight, nines, and tens a seven.
Hmm.
But as long as you sit there and don't give me a price and give me this blanket non-committal answer, nobody takes responsibility for anything. Well, that got the legislators' attention. And they called me the next day and they said, will you help us pass this legislation? So I went to the Capitol several different times, talked to them, did more interviews with the press. And Paul was killed on June 12th, 2021. It passed the House, I think in March of 2022, it passed the House and the Senate, because then it goes back and forth while they,
tweak it.
Yeah. And then it passed on May 22nd, 2022, which was the 2-year anniversary of the killing of my friend Jenna that I told you about.
Wow.
By a mentally ill man. I was on vacation with her mother. We were in Hawaii, and we were sitting on the beach, having dinner at the beach in Hawaii. It's so surreal. Watching the legislation on our phones on the anniversary of Jenna's death.
Wow.
While legislators in Minnesota are taking action to make sure that nobody else, or, make sure that nobody else gets killed like Paul and Jenna did.
What was the legislation? What did they actually do?
A couple of different things, and I don't know all of them, and I apologize for that. But the main thing that they do is they provide money for forensic navigators. So in the state of Minnesota, they were going to hire 120 forensic navigators. And you're getting a very layman's version of this.
Right.
I'm not an attorney. I have half of a music degree. That's what you're talking to here.
Okay.
And but basically, in my understanding, the way that I put it together in my head, it's almost like a parole officer for a mentally ill person, but it's not punitive. So I'm going to make myself...
They're trying to help
them. I'll make myself the patient again. Right. So I'm released provisionally. And now, if I don't show up at my appointments with my social worker, that social worker has the power to put me back in the hospital. We don't have to get judges to sign off on it. They have the power to take action right then. If I show up and say I'm taking my medication, but it's really obvious I'm not taking my medication, they have a lot more power and they can intervene on these mentally ill people so much sooner before they hurt themselves or hurt somebody else. And when you consider that one of the symptoms of several different mental illnesses, one of the symptoms is you don't want to take your medication. People who don't want to take their medication are not stupid. They're not weak. That's a symptom of their illness, for God's sake.
Well, I had a friend who was bipolar, and what happened is, of course, he needed to be on meds, so he would take the meds, then he would feel good, and then he would say, oh, well, I don't need them.
Well, that thought process right there, that's a symptom of mental illness.
Right, right.
And so we're faulting them, telling them they're bad people, considering them to be human beings with less intrinsic value than a cardiac patient,
right,
because they're acting on one of their symptoms. The thing about it is that people that have mental illnesses, sometimes their symptoms are not nice. They're ugly. They can be stinky. They can be really difficult, super difficult to deal with. One of the hooks in the story, and I think why the legislators wanted me to come on board, is my husband, Paul Pfeiffer, that was killed by a mentally ill man, was mentally ill. Mm. We lived with his mental illness, and we managed it. He was employed. He had about 20 employees. He was the boss. He had a very successful career, successful friendships, successful marriage, and a mental illness. And every couple of years, he had to go to the hospital, and we had to change medications. And it was hard, and it was difficult. It was really difficult. So I was a caretaker of somebody that was mentally ill. I also had my own mental illness, you know, in my 20s, coming out of an abusive childhood. So I had a pretty big understanding of all of this. So it passed on May 22nd. It was signed into law by Governor Walz, governor of Minnesota, on June 13th, 2022.
So a day.
Which is 1 year and 1 day after Paul's murder. They invited me to the signing. I have the pen, which I'm really happy about. So after all of this, remember we talked about a show, three hours ago?
Right.
I better give you some story here as to why we're doing this show. To be really honest, I needed to make sure that I didn't go back to drinking and that I stood upright, because after all of these things, I still wanted to collapse on my basement floor. I still had grief. I still had trauma. I still had PTSD. And I still had a life filled with angelic human beings all around me. My friends checked on me. My neighbors checked on me. After Paul was killed, I moved back to a neighborhood we'd previously lived in because those neighbors were so wonderful. I bought a house 500 feet from our old house that we'd lived in years before. And those neighbors didn't see me on Facebook or didn't hear from me. They were knocking on my door. So my life was just filled with really wonderful people. And I knew that I couldn't just depend on them to hold me up. And my family, my sister-in-law, my other siblings, my nieces and nephews, I had to start standing on my own 2 feet. I didn't want to die. And I didn't want Paul's murder to kill me or end my life. And I really liked what we did with this legislation. I made friends with the legislators and with the media folks that were so passionate about it, and it got me excited. And so I said I had half a music degree. Well, I worked in healthcare, but I also had a career in theater, musical theater. When Paul got sick, I needed to kind of give that up and go get a job that had a regular paycheck.
Right.
He did have a regular paycheck, but it was kind of a just-in-case thing. Right. What if one of these times he went to the hospital, he couldn't go back to work? I needed to be in place. And I remember saying to him after I got back from an audition, I had this great audition for this great new job that pays like crap, and I have to find a new one in 6 weeks. And it's like, that he was a banker. That didn't fly very well. So I had done some theater, and that's what I know how to do. And I knew I needed to keep giving to this cause. So I decided to form a foundation in his name. It's called the Paul James Pfeiffer Foundation. It is at thepauljamespfeiffer.org. If I had to do it over again, I wouldn't put the word the at the beginning, but it's there.
And in our notes, we'll put all that in the, so people can check it out.
Right. And our mission, I don't have the mission right here with me because my phone's in the other room, but our mission is to personally affect the lives of people suffering from mental illness and their caregivers, and let them know that this is a very general version of our quite concise mission.
Right.
Let them know that we believe that no matter what their symptoms, that they have the same intrinsic value as every other human being, including Christopher Rice, the man that murdered my husband. He's still in the hospital. He's still sick. He has a hearing coming up on May 7th that I will be at, where to determine whether he's capable of standing trial. I hate those hearings. I don't want to be in the same room with him. I get sick a week before, even being on Zoom. That's how we've had so far, but this one looks like it's going to be in person. The thought of that, it gets me down. It's awful. I don't want to be near this guy. I also know that there's no way that my husband would want me to hate another mentally ill man. And so I'm not going to do that. It also means that I have to advocate for him, just like I advocate for every other mentally ill person, because it's not about their symptoms. It's about their illness. And my own personal belief is that we are not islands. You know, if we were islands, my own personal belief is God would have put us on a planet all by ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so we have a certain responsibility to our fellow beings, and I can't exclude him from that. So I formed the foundation in Paul's name to advocate for care for mentally ill people. And our first fundraiser was last October, October of 2023, and it was a cabaret show called Guts and Gratitude, A Widower's Cabaret. And it was very successful. We raised over $30,000, cost about $20,000 to put on the show. To be really frank, I thought I was just going to lose money on the show, and we were just going to get the word out, and that was going to be the payoff. And then suddenly we had money in the bank, and there's laws about this. We're a 501c3, so you need to put your ducks in a row and figure out what you're going to do. So it was a really good problem to have. Wonderful people on the board of directors. The show was really successful.
And your nonprofit is based in
it's based in Minnesota. Yeah, okay. We are going to bring the show here to Palm Springs because there's a mental illness problem in Palm Springs, just like everywhere else in the world. And in Palm Springs, there are other gay widowers. It's just how it is. And there's probably other gay widowers whose husbands were murdered. My guess is not a ton. But I know that there's many whose spouses were mentally ill and committed suicide.
Mm.
And so there's a place here for that. And when we bring the show here, all the money that is earned here will stay in Palm Springs. The show coming up on May 5th at St. Joan of Arc Catholic Community in South Minneapolis at 1:30 p.m., Sunday at 1:30. It's a free will offering, general admission, no ticket sales. And it's part of their mental health week. They have a mental health week. It's a great church. I'm not Catholic anymore, but this is a very active and church that, you know, they put their money where their mouth is, and they have great outreach and great social justice. And they have a week in the fall and a week in the spring where it's dedicated to mental health awareness. And so this is part of their process. The show can be really emotional, but it's not a funeral at all. It's not a funeral at all. It starts out, and it's me, and I have four women in the show with me, and piano, drums, and a bass. And two of the women play the characters in the first scene of grief and trauma. And they love being grief and trauma. It's like, I'm trauma, I'm grief, how do you do? It's our job to ruin your life. You know, so it's very bawdy and campy. And then I come in and just kind of pretty much tell them to go to hell by singing Don't Rain on My Parade right in their face, and they scamper away like cockroaches in the sunlight.
Right.
And then we tell the story of falling in love with Paul and getting married and his mental illness and caring for him and then his murder. All those Facebook messages I told you about in that time in the murder, that's part of the show. We sing throughout the whole show different songs that apply to these things, and I tell the story of that and the story of recovering from that and the legislation. We show media of the legislation and the bill being signed. And then it's also about recovery. I have more years left in my life, and about falling in love again, which I've done. which has happened. I went to Palm. I had to go all the way to Palm Springs to meet a nice Lutheran man from Minnesota.
Wow.
Whose name is also Paul.
Wow.
Yeah. And when I think about the fact, I'm pretty convinced that first Paul had his hand in this, because New Paul, which he really hates being called.
New Paul
is a catch. And he's a wonderful man. And he's very much like Paul Pfeiffer. And Paul Pfeiffer would pick somebody for me named Paul just to screw with me. That is totally part of his sense of humor. My family and friends are like, what? I'm like, just get used to it. It's all good. And so we tell the story of all of that, about taking a breath after feeling like I was going to be found dead on my basement floor, huge amount of alcohol in my system. That is really what I thought was going to happen. And instead, because of all these angelic people in my life and the people that stepped forward and, I think, divinely inspired ability to open my eyes and see that they're there, because I think sometimes they're there, but we don't always see them. Something blocks them from our vision, and my vision was cleared, and I don't really know why. Seeing them helped me stand up, helped me decide to do something, to not let my husband die in vain. And, you know, Paul Pfeiffer was an introvert. And I'm obviously not. And
no,
I've never been called subtle.
Huh. You're talking to a type A,
yeah,
New York Leo here. So come on.
Yeah, exactly. That's very close to me too. And I love the fact. So if he was here, he would hate that I did a show about him. He would absolutely hate it. But I kind of had this feeling that where he is, he's not here, so he's fine with it. Because I talk about him, I sing about him, I sing about how easy he was to love and how easy he was to want to care for, even though the caring was hard. Yeah. Caring for a mentally ill person, even if you love them more than your life, is very, very, very hard. And it takes you to your wit's end. Mm. And it did. And then he and I would both bounce back. Mm. We had a couples therapist that we kind of had on retainer, pretty much.
Get him on speed dial.
Yeah. Because, well, we just learned that when Paul would get sick, when he would start to get better, we needed therapy to be a couple again. Because we fell right into patient and caregiver. Well, there's not a whole lot of romance in that kind of situation.
Right.
So we would go get 3 or 4 therapy sessions. And by about the third one, I'd look over and go, you're handsome. And then we were good again. And that was part of learning how to deal with a mental illness. And one thing that I want to say is I'm not some hero because we learned how to do that. Paul's mental illness wasn't as severe as Christopher Rice's. That's why we could do what we did and get better. I am convinced. I've never talked to Christopher Rice's family. I've reached out to them because
I was going to ask you that. So did he live with his family in that, in your house?
He lived with his girlfriend, but
girlfriend, okay.
When we would have these Zoom hearings, I would see people at first. After that, we started just using first names, but I would see people with the last name of Rice come on. And the first time that happened, I just got this overwhelming feeling that they were in the same situation that I was in when my husband was sick, and it was their sibling or their uncle or their son, I'm not really sure. And that when he killed Paul, I'm making this up. Nobody's told me this, but I just intuitively feel like there was a piece of them that went, oh my God, he finally did it. And so I have empathy for these people. Not only that, but they're terrified. They're terrified that their sick loved one is going to spend the rest of his life in prison. So I'm not a wimp. I'm not a wuss. I know what he did. I know what he did. But my husband would never want me to hate another mentally ill man. And the other thing is he doesn't have a criminal record outside of things he did while being mentally ill. They're all attached to some kind of a psychiatric incident. And the Hennepin County attorney told me that the Hennepin County is where Paul was murdered. And that's the county on the Minneapolis side of the Twin Cities. And that changed everything for me. So it was like, wow, this really is because he was sick. And I said to the Hennepin County attorney, is there a lot of difference in him if he had epilepsy and he had a seizure and ran over Paul? Mm-hmm. And they said, not a ton, you know.
Because the one with epilepsy, people would...
You'd have say, more...
Oh, I understand.
I understand that because he wasn't conscious. Well, this
right.
This man thought that Paul was a person who was hurting his mother, and the voices in his head told him if he didn't kill Paul, Paul would keep hurting his mother. He didn't make it up. He's got history of this kind of thing. It's documented like crazy. I am not a pushover. In fact, I have kind of a temper. So I would never back off somebody that I thought
it was really guilty.
Was really guilty. Believe me, they would get it full force. So one of my goals with this show and the show that we did in October got media coverage again. I went back to those same media people and we got some media coverage for that, which is good. I did some interviews on TV and on the radio. And the show coming up, the congresswoman who was one of the co-sponsors of the bill is going to be there. One thing that I would hope, because I reached out to Christopher Rice's family and it was kind of a dead end. I got word back that they were very concerned and very tentative and suspicious, which I don't blame them, frankly. They I went through my attorney.
Right.
But I would hope the word would get back to them that I'm not taking a stand against their loved one. I'm taking a stand against us not considering mentally ill people to have the same intrinsic value as everybody else and taking a stand against not serving them properly. That being said, I still don't want to be in the same room with Christopher Rice. I still get literally physically sick when I have to be on Zoom calls. I still dread them a week at a time. The next hearing is May 7th, and I literally just this morning, when I was meeting with our friend Mark, talked to my advocate for the county, because victims' loved ones get an advocate when somebody's murdered. And I said, will you start what I ask you to do every time? Will you find out, is it going to get canceled? Is it going to be on Zoom? I need to prepare myself emotionally for this hearing. So both things exist. Both things exist. I'm horrified by what he did, and I don't want to be around him. But if I don't advocate for him just like everybody else, then I'm not in integrity. You know, you can't leave people out, or your whole stance is false. At least, I don't want to say you, because that's what I think about myself, the way that I was raised and the way that I believe being a good man is. That's what I have to do. I'm not going to put that on anybody else because I'm not part of their equation.
So you're not going to shit on them.
I'm not going to shit on them. Yeah.
You should do this. I have a question for you. So have you stopped drinking yourself?
Yes. I was just going to say, so I've heard that shit on them thing because, you know, I go to these support groups that you don't tell anybody that you're in, you know, sometimes. Right. But suddenly when I started going to them, I stopped drinking.
You mentioned that you'd been drinking like a fish and then you were going to do the first interview and you stopped drinking that day.
That
did that stop or did you work into?
Well, what happened, if people come to the show, they can hear all about this. What happened is I came to Palm Springs to escape the pressure, the media coverage. There was a wrongful death lawsuit. There was the criminal side and I was crumbling. This is before the interview. I was in contact, but it was before, it was scheduled. And it was in February. I came in January 21st and I scheduled a massage with a wonderful healing human being named Mark Hollenstein. And I went there and the massage was great. It was really a good massage. But what happened in there was more a spiritual experience. He's also a sensitive energy worker and
healer. He's a healer.
Yeah. And I'll be really honest, I talk about it in my show. My husband came to me in that room and told me to get my liver checked. He was very concerned about my liver. Mark said he's emphatic. He wants you to get your liver checked. Well, one thing that nobody else on the planet knew, nobody, was that 3 weeks earlier I went to the doctor to get my liver checked because I thought if I have a bad liver, I'll stop drinking. And I had a bad liver. I had liver damage from my drinking. And I didn't stop. And Paul came through in this session and he told me, he said, you have a mission to do. You don't really know what it is yet, but you do. You have a mission. And if you drink, you will die and it'll be hard and your mission will not get done. It's really important, Joseph. You have to stop. And Mark was very kind. Yeah, I sobbed. It was just really powerful. And we're walking out. He walks me to the end of his driveway and he says, do you see that park down there? It was about, I don't know, 80 feet away.
Right. A couple hours away. Yeah.
There's an AA meeting in that park in about 45 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. And he said, you know, I can give you a blanket or a little lawn chair if you want to go over there and wait. And I did. And I went to AA every day that I was down here. I went back to my hotel room and I poured jugs of alcohol down the drain. Then I went back to Minnesota and I did the interview and I was sober for the interview. Then things got bad again and I flew back to Palm Springs and I thought, look, any good alcoholic. And I didn't go to, I went to AA a little bit in Minnesota. I decided I deserved alcohol on the plane on the way back down here, you know. And I had three drinks, and that'll be good. And I was going to have three drinks the next day, and I did. And I was going to have three drinks the next day, and I had nine. So since that day, which was, what's the date today?
April 18th.
That was April 21st, 2022.
Okay.
And I've continued to work with Mark for healing, for the healing of the trauma and what it did to my own energy and my own stance as a human being. And it's helped me be strong enough to do this media work and do the legislative work and to co-write and produce a wonderful cabaret show that is healing for people to see and healing for people to perform in. Everybody in the show knew and loved Paul. He just surrounded himself with really talented people. So it was really, you know, I didn't have to reach very far to find people to do it.
Pick the low fruit. There they are.
Right. And the show has some really good names behind it. Greta Grosch. Google this name, Greta Grosch. She wrote a very successful series of musicals called The Church Basement Ladies, based in Minnesota, all about the ladies that cook the lunch in the church basement from, I think, the 50s to the 80s. There's nine different versions of the show. Mm. They're all over the country playing at different times. And there's a movie coming out that they're about to start filming based on this. She co-wrote it. She's a friend of Paul's and a friend of mine, and she co-wrote this with me. Which basically means I told a story and she put it in order and wrote it down and made it funny. I'm a little generous to put a co in front of my name or put co-write in front of my name, but I guess I did. And then Kevin Roddy, who's a very well-known music director in Minnesota, he's written some national tour musicals, and that's how I met him. I was part of that. And then some really great musicians otherwise, and all of them knowing and loving Paul. And we make It's a really good show.
Do you have a date for the Palm Springs one yet?
Not yet, because we don't have a site yet. Okay. I have, which I won't say on here. We talked about
checking it out.
Yeah. We're checking out locations and seeking sponsorship to bring the show down here so it can actually earn some money and put money back into that to help people with mental illness here. The way that I feel led to make a difference in Palm Springs is in the homeless population or the unhoused, mm-hmm. because mental illness is so often just hand in hand with people that are unhoused. And I've had some actually quite spiritual experiences here talking to people that are unhoused where I'm a spiritual man. I am a person who prays. I'm a person who meditates. I know my insights pretty well. I've lived through a lot in my life. We're going to talk about that in different sessions, but I recovered from child sexual abuse. At one time in my life, I was 190 pounds heavier than I am right now. I've been 190 pounds thinner for 25 years. So taking on things it's not my first rodeo, and that has caused me to have a pretty deep spiritual being. And I had encounters with some unhoused people, not all of them, where I really felt like this encounter is telling me that this is where the Paul James Pfeiffer Foundation can make a difference in Palm Springs, California. So I'm excited to do that and to bring that down here because I love it here.
Question, do you have a drinking problem before Paul was killed?
Not if you asked me.
What would Paul have said?
Yes.
Paul would say yes.
Yeah. Okay. I was a pretty good control drinker, you know, like you would get bad and then I would pull it back. But why did I keep going back to it?
So how have you changed in the last 3 years?
So the answers are a little bit narcissistic, just, you know.
I'm good with it.
I am stronger than I ever thought I would ever be in this lifetime. I'm not afraid of things. I still have PTSD from Paul's murder. Some, not a lot, but there's a gift in this, which, you know, I don't know if you call it a gift, but I don't care. I look what I lived through. I don't care what you think of me. Mm. I care that I make a difference and that I am the man that Paul Pfeiffer wants me to be, and that in his name, I affect people. Can affect people and make a space for them to have healing. That's very, very important to me. but I used to be really worried about what people thought of me and judgments and how did I do. I don't care. I don't care. I lived through being with my husband when he was murdered. I don't care. Why am I going to participate in that conversation? Which makes a difference, because when you start doing that, you don't attract those people into your life anymore. So now that I know how I would tell them all off, I don't ever need to, because I don't attract them into my life. So I feel a lot of strength. I feel a lot of hope. I notice angels all around me all the time. And I am so incredibly grateful. Paul Pfeiffer and I used to come here on vacation. That's why I chose to come to Palm Springs, to escape all of that. And now I live here part of the year.
A lot of people come from Minnesota.
I know. I have a neighbor who says, "Is anybody left in Minnesota?" When I walk and I see the palm trees and the mountains and I feel the energy here, that to me, that's a gift. It's a complete gift. And the fact that I have the ability to do that, not everybody has ability to do that, you know, it's humbling to think about. You know, my husband made sure that I would be able to go past his death financially and things like that. Well, you know, there's widows and widowers out there that have kids that isn't true for, and they still have to go back to their 9-to-5 job a week after their spouse was murdered, and they have to figure out daycare, and they have to be a parent to these children who had this trauma happen in their families. And so it's been humbling in that sense, that I'm very privileged, and it's very, very humbling. And I am a little, not freaked out, because it's not freaked out, but I'm aware of how weird it is to sit across from you 2.5 years after my husband was murdered in my presence and say, "I am privileged." But it's all true. It's all true. And if you knew the beautiful people that I have in my life, which you're one of, frankly, and they know me, you know, grieving, when you're grieving, you're not always you're kind of an ugly person sometimes. Right. And there's plenty of them that would sit back and go, "Oh, yes, you are.
Go to your room, bitch. Get over it."
Exactly. You know, my sister doesn't say the word bitch, but yeah, she thought that many times, I'm sure. Yeah.
All right, sir. We're going to do we're going to backtrack and do another episode.
Okay.
Sometime soon. And we'll get into your history a little bit, but we wanted to start with this one.
Can I tease it just a little bit?
Sure.
I had been a guest on the Oprah Winfrey Show long before Paul's murder. And so I'm just teasing that so they come back for the next episode. And it has to do with...
That was because you're a juggling act, right?
That's it, yeah. I can high-wire juggle at 385 pounds. And yeah.
Wow.
It has to do with recovering from child sexual abuse. So I joke with Mark, my energy guy, the guy that I go for counsel, and I kind of consider him my spiritual director.
And Mark is one of my
podcasts. Yeah, Mark Hollenstein. And I joke with him and say, you know, I think I'm the Forrest Gump of bad shit. So, you know, because Forrest Gump, you know, he was found himself in all these big, huge situations, and right. It was all good, and he just kind of stumbled into greatness. And I also feel like I'm in greatness now, too, because of the love that's in my life. But when I tell people the things that have happened throughout my life, I feel like they think I'm making it up. Like I'm one of those people that makes up dramatic stories that you can't really track down. Well, mine are trackable.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
We will be putting this out pretty soon. And I need some notes to put in the notes.
Okay.
So you got to give me those.
But I can give you those.
Great. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.